The following Dharma talk was done by Lawrence Doan Greco at Open Sky Zen in New York City. For more information about Open Sky, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
You know, in Zen, there's a saying, the gem is already in your hand. The gem is already in your hand. And gems and jewels and gold are often used or have been used throughout the centuries as wonderful metaphors for this nature the Buddha often talked about, this Buddha nature he says we all have. He spent, or legend has it, says he spent about 6 or 7 years on this quest for enlightenment. So he left his home, he left a wife and newborn baby son, which was the thing to do at the time. Today it seems scandalous. And he embarked on this journey to figure out, why do people feel dissatisfied all the time? Why do people suffer? Why do people always feel like they lack something? Why do we always feel like this isn't quite enough, this isn't quite right? So he spent many years figuring out some answer, trying to figure out what spiritual practice is going to help me figure this out. Because he figured, I suffer too, and I see other people suffer. So what causes it, and then how can I help end it? That's all he cared about. So he tried all kinds of extreme practices. You know, these hardcore yogis he met who would starve themselves all day and have just enough rice just to, like, not die. He tried that, and said, no, that doesn't really work. Tried all kinds of stuff. And then one day he just said, on his own, I'm going to sit under this tree until I figure this out, until I really wake up. So the story says that he saw the morning star at dawn. And he said, ah, how wonderful. How wonderful all of this is. So he didn't discover something he didn't have. He discovered something within himself that was always there, but he didn't know was there. Just as, you know, that feeling you have when you're looking around frantically for something, your house keys, and oh, they're right in my pocket. There they are. And what a relief it is, and how foolish you feel when the thing you were searching for is right there. But it felt so removed, so distant, and that there's this desperation about finding it. God, if I don't have my keys, I can't leave, I'm stuck. What do I do? Or what if someone else has them? What if someone, you know, all kinds of nightmare scenarios come up. So in Zen we say sometimes, the gem is already in your hand. Even like if you want to do it, like, what does your hand feel like when you've got something in it? Right? What does it feel like when I have something in my hand? And what does it feel like when I'm reaching for something constantly? What is it doing? What's the difference? Tell me, what's the difference? Or do it. What's the difference between holding something and reaching for something? Nobody can tell me?
Wait.
What?
Wait.
Wait. Okay. So you feel a weight in your hand? Mm-hmm.
Focus.
A focus? On what? What do you mean? Focus how? You mean focus when you're reaching or when you're holding or?
I guess when you're reaching.
Okay.
The anticipation.
Anticipation.
Of the thing that.
Right, okay.
Sort of feel off balance.
Right, if you're reaching forward for something. Ah.
Somewhere center where you're looking, that's over there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we sit, right, I don't teach you to, like, all right, spine straight, reach forward. No, you're just sitting straight. You're doing this or you're doing this. There's no grasping.
Stillness?
Stillness, when you're not reaching.
trying to go outside yourself.
Exactly, right. Which is completely at odds with the meditation posture of being just here, just like this. This is fine, right here. Every statue you see of the Buddha, check him out. What's he doing? It's like everything's fine. I'm not going anywhere. I don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go anywhere. It's a wonderful old story about a very poor man many years ago, dressed like this kind of raggy old robes and jacket. And he went to visit a very wealthy old friend of his who lived in a palace. They hadn't seen each other in years. And this man wasn't always this poor. So his wealthy friend saw him and took him in, and he gave him one of the best meals he'd had in a long time. And he gave him lots of wine, lots to drink. So the poor man got very drunk. By midnight, he was plastered and he passed out. And his wealthy friend let him sleep. He had his attendants bring him to the best bed in the house. And the wealthy man went to sleep. But he had to get up at 6 a.m. for an important business meeting. So he got up and he wanted to say goodbye to his friend and help him out. But the poor guy was still sleeping, probably really hungover. So he didn't know what to do. He didn't have any time. There were no, you know, cell phones. There was no PayPal. So he just took one of his most precious jewels that he owned from his collection. And he went over to the man, the poor man who was sleeping in this beautiful bejeweled bed. And he sewed the jewel into the seam of his jacket. And he sewed it shut. He's like, he'll wake up and he'll feel it and he'll know. And it's the kind of jewel that if he sold this thing, like, he could get a one-bedroom apartment in the West Village and have rent covered for 20 years and not have to worry about groceries or utilities. He'd be set. That's what a generous, wealthy man this guy was. So the poor man woke up, yawned, went about his way, and he resumed begging as he usually did. He used to beg every day just for scraps or food or coins, just so he could get by. So he didn't realize he had this precious jewel in his jacket. He had no idea. So months go by, and he's begging every day, wearing the same jacket, same tattered jacket. It's getting dirtier and dirtier. He's getting skinnier and skinnier from hunger. And then a few years later, his wealthy friend is in town, walking around, and he sees his old friend sitting on a corner begging. And he says, "What are you doing begging for food? What are you doing?" He says, "Don't you know that I left you with one of my most precious jewels?" And he reached down to the guy and he goes, "It's right here. Feel it? It's right here. It's still there." So this man was existing as if he had nothing, as if he always had to beg for something, for some sustenance, for some money, for some food. Not knowing he had everything he needed right there. So his mind changed drastically the second he realized what he had. Everything felt lighter. He didn't feel as hungry. He didn't feel as tired. He felt very grateful. He felt loved. So same person, same situation, and then everything changed with the realization. Just his friend pointing out, "Don't you see what you have there?" So we're like the poor man when we operate from this place of, "I don't have enough, I'm screwed up, I'm not good enough, I'm too young, I'm too old, I'm too unhealthy, I'm too whatever." We're always too something, or we don't have something. Or when, if only I had something, then my life can begin and then I'd be happy. And we do this constantly, constantly. And this whole world is set up to keep us in that mind state so that the economic system can continue. So I don't want the economy of the United States to collapse. But how much are we just suffering from this mistaken view that we're lacking, and we need someone or something else to make us feel complete. You know, even a good teacher can't do it for you. All a teacher should do, Alan Watts was a very famous philosopher. He actually called himself a spiritual entertainer. He's a brilliant man. There are a lot of his recordings of his lectures from the 50s and 60s out there, and even some YouTube clips that I encourage you to check out. He was a brilliant man, very interested in all kinds of religions, but particularly Zen and Buddhism. Alan Watts, W-A-T-T-S. He's written several books, even on Zen. And he said something once like, a spiritual teacher is just like a pickpocket trying to sell you your own watch. And that's the best way to describe what a spiritual teacher is. That's the best way to describe what I am. So I cannot give you something you don't have. Hopefully, my job as a teacher, as a friend, is to very gradually help you to understand what's already there. And part of how we do that is through sitting practice, right? Just sitting still, believe it or not, gradually helps us see the reality of who and what we are versus the mythology we build around ourselves and our lives. So this is a practice of letting go and discarding, not a practice of acquiring. You don't have to buy all that crap up there. You don't have to have a fancy statue or a gray jacket and pants. None of that is what does it. The Buddha was not a Buddhist. You probably didn't know from Zen. Didn't know what Zen was. There was no Zen. Another parable that illustrates this story beautifully. There was a very wealthy nobleman whose very young son one day got lost in a market when they were out shopping. Maybe the kid was 7 years old. So despite all this man's resources and all of the help and all of the support he had, no one could find his son anywhere. He tried for years. He never gave up. So years go by. Maybe, let's say, so one day, he's looking out the window of his beautiful home, and he sees this teenager knock at the door, beg for food, and one of his attendants gives the kid some food. Maybe he's like 16 or 17. And the man recognizes that as his son. And he screams to his attendant, "Get that, that's my son, that's who we lost. Whatever, 10 years ago. That's him, I'm sure it's him." So the attendants went after the kids. "Hey, oh, the owner of the home needs to speak to you, he needs to talk to you." But the kid was so, he was just poor and dirty and just, "Look, all I wanted to do was beg for some money and food. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cause any trouble. I didn't do anything illegal. I just want to get out of here. I don't want to talk to him. I didn't do anything. I'm sorry." And he just bolted. He left. So realizing that where his son was in his life and in his mind and heart at that moment, after all those years of being lost and begging for food, he said, all right, he wasn't able to hear that he's the son of one of the wealthiest people in this province. Okay. So he got one of his young attendants to dress like a beggar. And he sent him out. He said, "Go find my son. Befriend him. Just act like you're just as poor as he is. Hang out with him for a few weeks. And then tell him you found a pretty decent paying job doing gardening for me." So he did this. His attendant put on some dirty clothing, hung out with the nobleman's son for several weeks. And just, you know, out of the blue one, to say, hey, you know what? I got this pretty decent gig doing gardening. It pays okay. It doesn't pay great, but it pays okay. And it beats begging for food. Do you want to do it with me? He needs two guys. So the nobleman's son said, sure, that sounds perfect. That sounded like a reasonable job for him, something he could deal with. So he started working, unbeknownst to him, for his own father, doing gardening. Never even saw his employer. He just did some gardening. Then he would leave, come back in the morning, do some gardening, leave at night. And then 6 months later, he promoted his son, who didn't know it was his son, to a servant, to one of his servants in the house. Much nicer, cushier job, much easier job. So he did that, and the kid did a really good job for several years. And then eventually, the nobleman promoted him to his personal assistant, secretary. So he was able to spend most of his days with his son close at hand, helping out, learning how the house is run, learning all the ins and outs of his business and how the land is kept. And then eventually, when the man became very old, at this point, his son, who still didn't know he was his son, because he couldn't conceive of it, his son was left in charge of just about everything. He managed the property, all the affairs of the house, all the finances. He trusted him with everything. And as this old man was dying, he knew he was dying, he called all of his assistants and servants and staff around his bed and said, this is actually my son. This is the boy we lost 20 years ago. This is him. He's a grown man now. I leave everything to him. This is all rightfully his. My fortune, my estate, my palace, everything. So, some 15 years earlier, this young man couldn't conceive of all of this, of himself being even remotely related to this man. He just saw this as, I'm this poor homeless guy begging for food. And just the mere mention that the nobleman wanted to see him scared the hell out of him. Just as sometimes the idea that maybe we're not as screwed up as we think we are doesn't sit so well with us. So if you don't believe that you do have this Buddha nature, that your true nature is inherently good and clear and open and compassionate, if that is the reality of who you are, start with something smaller. And start the way that the young man had to start as a gardener. But you have to start with something. This isn't really not a spiritual tradition where we emphasize belief or faith, but you do have to have a little faith. Even if your faith is in, you know, maybe what I'm hearing today isn't complete bullshit. Maybe there's something to it. Maybe I'll give it a try. And if I don't see a glimpse of this Buddha nature in a year, then I'm out of here. Even if you start with that, that's like being the gardener. Start there. So this is usually a story to illustrate how teachers work with students. But I use it as a story to illustrate how we can work with wherever we feel we are at any given time. And when the Buddha had his big awakening under the Bodhi tree and he saw that star in the morning and he said, oh wow, this is so cool, I didn't know. I already have everything I've been searching for. And not just me, but everyone, all beings are inherently awake and clear and good and complete, and none of us need anything. None of us are lacking anything, even though we think we are. That's how we started teaching people. He went around telling people this. And guess how they reacted? They looked at him like he was crazy. They're like, what the hell are you talking about? We're all screwed up. We're sinners. We're vile creatures. We're misdirected. We don't know what we're doing. We're always making mistakes. So he actually adapted to where they were. That's right. That's how you feel about yourselves? Okay. I'll tell you what. You all have to repent and purify yourselves. So this is what his earliest teachings were like, apparently. So here are your precepts. Follow the precepts. Purify yourself. Then you'll be okay. You've got to repent. And they liked that. That they could relate to. And then gradually over the years, he kept fine-tuning his teachings to more of what we teach now in the Mahayana tradition. And he did this for 40 years. He taught for 40 years, a long time, until about the age of 80 or so. So just consider, even like throughout the week, the gem is already in your hand. Anytime if you're feeling like, inadequate, you're feeling sad, you're feeling anxious. We feel all of those things several times throughout every day, I'm sure. Maybe remember that phrase, the gem is already in your hand. Even if you don't believe it, even if it doesn't help immediately, it's a nice little phrase to keep in mind. Hopefully it'll remind you of some of what I'm saying today. Now it's open discussion, question, comment time. You can ask about anything at all. It could be related to what I just talked about or not. It could be related to meditation practice or your life. No one asks a question, someone's going to get hit. I'm going to start with... How does this sit with you? Oh, yes, go ahead.
So is the story with the gem, is that the solution to happiness, to that person's happiness, having the gem?
I guess the point of the story is that happiness, as we normally define it, is not to be acquired externally. And what we normally equate with happiness is not true happiness. So what we normally look at as happiness is experiencing pleasurable sensations and feelings. That's kind of what happy, right? Happy feels like, I feel good. My body feels kind of good. Or I'm eating something that's pleasurable to my taste buds. I'm getting this, I have this kind of job. That feels good right now. I'm happy. Which is fine. It's fine to be relatively happy. But once happiness is based on anything external or fleeting, which is just about anything external becomes fleeting, then we're setting ourselves up for suffering. So this doesn't mean we should not want nice things, want a nice relationship, want a nice job, want a new watch. Just so long as we realize that's not going to do it, that's not going to make me happy necessarily, not in the real, true, lasting, enduring sense. Doing this thing may satisfy my hunger temporarily. Or sometimes the way we satisfy our hunger feels good as we do it, and then we feel disgusting an hour later because we binged or ate really bad food. Or we do whatever we do to bring about instant gratification, which feels like happiness. And that's the trick of all this, is that it feels like doing the thing that's going to make us happy works because it brings about instant gratification. Oh, this must be working. But then long term, is it working? No. We've all done things that seemed like a great idea at the time. Maybe they were impulsive or not so impulsive. And then in retrospect, oh boy, no. That wasn't good at all. So happiness is an interesting word. I don't always know even... it's what we all want. We all want two things, right? We all want to be happy, and that's perfectly normal. And we all want not to suffer. So that's what levels the playing field for everyone. That's what motivates all our behavior. It's just what we do to bring about happiness and to rid ourselves of suffering is often very inappropriate or misguided because we're misrelating to things as they are, we're misrelating to ourselves, we're misrelating to life. In a sense, it's like we're, you know, horse is always running with a carrot dangling in front of our heads. And that's what we do almost all the time. When my first Zen teacher, some student, he would often just say, is this not enough? That's another good question once in a while. Is this not enough? And it feels, most of the time, it feels like, no, it's not enough, actually. There's always something off about the moment. There's always something that could be better. And we're always doing that. That's how our brains are wired. So we don't, which is fine, doesn't mean, so that's actually not a problem. Knowing how that brain process works helps us not be ruled by it. So if I understand that the Buddha taught dukkha is part of life, the Buddha taught we're kind of wired to feel like something's always missing, something's not quite good enough, I'm not quite good enough, I'm a little too hungry, it's a little warm in here, some people think it's a little chilly. Whatever we do, that's a normal part of being alive. So just starting with that understanding is kind of a relief. I'm like, okay, I'm actually supposed to feel like bitching about something all the time. I always feel like bitching about something. And then in knowing that, then you don't feel as likely to complain. And then you could settle into life with more, okay, so it's supposed to feel a little off and awkward. So maybe it's not... so bad. So maybe I can look more deeply into this moment if it's never going to feel perfect. And then I could settle into it differently. And then you'll get these moments, and hopefully longer moments, longer and longer, of actually, wow, everything's quite nice. Everything's quite fine. Not bad. Life is good. So life is good doesn't mean I always feel pleasant feelings. Life is good doesn't mean I never feel depressed or angry, pissed off, jealous, but it means I'm fully aware of it as it's happening and I don't let it jerk me around by the neck like a dog on a leash. I understand that's all coming and going and there's something else here at work.